WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new CD, Come Dancing, collects the later hits of the Kinks from 1977 to 86. They were one of the English bands that crossed the ocean during the British invasion of the 60s and are one of the few that endured through the decades. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of the Kinks. The Kinks have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Their early hits included such sexually driven songs as You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night, and Tired of Waiting for You, songs that later influenced the new wave bands of the next generation. After those early records, Davies started writing songs that were social satires of the time, like Well-Respected Man and Dedicated Follower of Fashion. I spoke with him in 1995, after the publication of his memoir, X-Ray. We opened with Dedicated Follower of Fashion.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
Thinks he is a flower to be looked at, and when he pulls his frilly nylon and his raked up tight, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion.
I asked Ray Davies to take us back to the early days of the Kinks. The band started performing under the name The Ravens.
It was my brother's band. He was 13 years old. I'd left and gone to college, and I didn't really see Dave. In fact, I didn't live with my brother when we were growing up. I come from a large family, and I explain this in my book, in the sense that I had five sisters, much older, and so much older that... I grew until I was 5 years old. I called my eldest sister mother, so it was very confusing, especially for my mother. But coming from that background, so I didn't really have that the standard brother relationship with Dave, and I left home and went to college and came back, and there was this incredible, this stunning guitarist who knew all these sort of choppy lyrics, lyrical guitar phrases. And he was much better than I was. So I was suddenly reduced to... I wanted to be sort of a jazz guitarist, blues guitarist. I was reduced to being the rhythm guitarist in The Ravens. And Dave was out there in front strutting around and doing his sort of... I don't know, his thing. It was an odd little band, really. Because, you know, we were sort of kids, really. It's.
Were you writing songs for it?
Nope. I didn't, we were a covers band. Well, covers, doing things like Smokestack Lightning by and John Lee Hooker songs and Howling Wolf, Smokestack Lightning, and all those sort of laudable, you know, earthy, profound blues songs. And it was only later on that we got into Chuck Berry songs. But Chuck Berry was a big influence to me as a lyricist, obviously, later on, when I started writing songs. But I had no aspirations to write songs then. I just wanted to play and do well.
Now, how did you start writing then?
I'd written poetry, and I think when we tried to get a record contract, the publishers were giving us songs that were similar to hits of the day, like She Loves You and Beatles songs. And I thought, well, there's no possibility of us actually doing as well as those people. So why not write our own songs? And I started writing seriously, I suppose. I'd only tinkered with it in the past, you know, writing instrumentals. I would write guitar solos to play in the band. As I said, I wanted to be sort of more of an instrumentalist rather than a lyricist. And the lyrics really when I started writing, it was like an outlet of all these, I guess, young frustrations, you know, normal teenage torment. And I found it very therapeutic. And I've always had insomnia, so I actually found something, and slightly before the days of all-night television, so I found something I could do all night.
It rhyme.
Yes, sitting there and with rhyming couplets. Yeah.
Now, tell a story of how the band got the name The Kinks.
Yeah, well, The Kinks were in a pub after rehearsal, and Dave, my brother, and Pete, who was the bass player at the time, wore these capes and leather capes and high boots. And I guess for the early, mid-60s, that was quite outrageous. And Kinky Boots, I think, was a single that it was a program called The Avengers had out. It was a TV show. And this guy standing at the bar, sort of, you know, nonchalantly looking over, half drunk, looking at us and saying, "You blokes who call yourselves The Kinks, because you look like them." I just didn't know quite what to say to this man. And then a man called Larry Page was standing with us, who became one of our managers. He said, "You know, you've got a point there. He's got the point, that guy. You should call yourselves The Kinks." The good thing about The Kinks is that it did leave an impression with people, whether it was good or bad. It was a short, punchy, one-syllable word. And we were on the bottom of a bill with other artists. And our name was the smallest, so it had to be just a few letters. So it seemed to, foot the bill or fit the bill in every respect. And it was a name that really people remembered.
So did you have to visually play up the idea of Kinky?
I've always hated the name The Kinks. It's just, I think it's a daft name.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can't think of anything else to call us now except The Kinks. It's just, it's evolved. It's got our own meaning. Yes, it has kinkiness and whatever. But I think those connotations are not quite... I think The Kinks mean, in a true sense, maybe the edges or the wrinkles in society that maybe shouldn't be straightened out. And it's always opposed to walking the straight line always, because life isn't just a straight line.
The first hit that you had was with your song, You Really Got Me. And you write in your book that this was considered too risky to record. What were the problems?
Well, it was, it wasn't, I suppose, wholesome enough to be, for the time, something that would be palatable for radio. And now it sounds really innocent people say, "Well, what's wrong with the lyric?" But for then, you've got to understand, it's a time when people still, although the Beatles were supposed to be a rough and ready outfit and the Rolling Stones were, there was still an element of polish about what everybody did. And The Kinks were a rough and ready outfit, there's no question about it. And so the record company eventually relented and let us record it and to get our character. And that record really epitomises a lot of the way we feel that the fuzzy, raw sound that Dave worked so hard to get is really the way the band sounded. And that's, I think, why it was a success.
Well, it's such a great record. Why don't we hear it? And this is The Kinks, You Really Got Me. My guest is Ray Davies, and he has a new unauthorized autobiography called X-Ray. Now, what were you thinking about when you wrote the song?
Not a lot, really. It's not a lot.
How did the line come to you?
I'd written a song a few years... As I said, I tried to write instrumental phrases, and I'd been writing those a few years earlier. And there was this repetitive phrase, and going into strange accents and things. And I just probably sat there. We just had dinner at home. I went into the front room of the parlour where we had the piano, the little upright piano, and I started thumping this idea I'd thought of a few years earlier. And the words just came out. I think the subconscious was composing. It was not thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the trick. It just the words evolved with the notes and they match. And looking at the lyric, if I'd brought the lyric to, you know, to somebody and said, write music to that, they'd probably tell me to get out, you know, because it's not very, doesn't look very inspiring. It's like all these things, when you put the two pieces together, lyric and music, it adds up to something in a strange way.
Now, you said in your book that someone in your management said, well, I don't know whether you're singing to a boy or a girl, so you better put a girl's name in there somewhere.
That's right, yeah. Well, he was concerned about my, about what, you know, who I was singing to and what my audience was. And I'm thankful in a sense that he suggested that I make it, I personalize it, because although I didn't use a name at the end, I thought girl would be appropriate. And but just thinking about that change probably gave me the, I know it's not pretentious, but maybe it is, a psychological, and maybe my voice, the way I sang it sounded different. I sang the thing like I knew roughly where it was directed. And so although I didn't use Susan or Barbara or whatever, Barbara, you really got me going, I sang girl, and I had an image of somebody there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your book that you managed to keep the R&B feel even though making a pop record.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, that's really true. And also you write that you made a conscious effort to make your voice sound pure and to sing clearly, which I think is really interesting, considering that kind of really like fuzzy, aggressive guitar sound, and you're trying to sing, you know, purely and clearly. It's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, I think it's like the old line, Noel Coward line, you know, remember the lines and speak clearly. We had made You Really Got Me once before, and we'd gone in with the producers and everything, and I'd been on tour, and my voice was a bit croaky, a bit like it is now, and You Really Got Me going. It's like really down there. So I remember that when we came to do the vocal, and we only had 3 hours to do it, so there was I, like, with 10 minutes to go, and it had to be right. So I thought, I took my voice up a bit, and again, thought I was higher, singing in a higher register than I was. And so emotionally, I was up there in the mid-frequencies, even though my voice was quite gravelly.
Yeah, because your voice got more pure and clear in later records, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. The diction kicked in, the diction factor.
Right, which was never a big thing in rock and roll.
No, but again, our agents, who did come from another era, it was that sort of transition from, I don't know, theatre, I guess. They always said, sing, I know it's blues, but you must be heard.
Well, they sent in someone named Hal Carter. Was that his real name?
Hal, yes. Well, he told me it was his real name.
Okay. So he was sent in to work on your stage act. Mm. Why did they think you needed professional help with your stage act?
Well, we all need professional help from time to time. Maybe we needed it more than other people. As I said, we were a scruffy lot.
Uh-huh.
And musically confused, and I suppose immature. And because our first record had flopped, you know, it was an abysmal flop.
This was not You Got Me. This
it wasn't You Really Got Me. We put out another single, which was a cover. It flopped. It was somebody else's song. They thought, well, this band have got to do something because they're on the tour now with all these other bands, and they must appear to be better than what they are. And I think they sent Hal along to structure our show a bit.
So what kind of advice did he give you?
He told me how to stand, and my brother, I remember he used to tell Dave to rave on his own in the corner, which I'm not quite sure what he meant by that, but jump up and down, and how to take a bow, all that stuff.
How should you take a bow?
Well, normally I sort of bend down and curtsy. It's...
Did he have you bowing as if you were doing Shakespeare or something?
Is that sort of how to
or singing in a Vegas club?
And we used to listen to him, and then we used to go on stage and do exactly what we wanted to do in the first place. It was wonderful. He did give us some, I'm sure some of it stuck with us, but it was just, I think it was fear that we might not cut it, I suppose. And they were concerned that we were not to fail. But you see, the trick is, with the Kinks, was that we could only be the way we were. And when we found that magic combination of the sound that we had, which was, I think, quite original, and the look, the combination worked. And that's why that also helped You Really Got Me to become a success.
What was the look?
Well, they found, we went to see this wonderful man called Monty Berman. He used to do, used to be the costume designer in lots of, well, mediocre British movies in the 50s, I think, and 60s. And by this time, in the mid-60s, he was, you know, he had a big industry, you know, just renting out costumes. And he found these red riding jackets. And he combined those with sort of Regency-style frilly shirts, yellow frilly shirts, and strange boots and black trousers. And suddenly we walked on stage and we looked like the Kinks, whatever that is.
My guest is Ray Davies of the Kinks. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1995 interview with Ray Davies, co-founder, lead singer, and songwriter of the Kinks. The new CD, Come Dancing, is a collection of the Kinks recordings from 1977 to 86. Now, what was it like for you when the band caught on in the States? Maybe you could tell us about your first American tour.
Our first American tour was an absolute catastrophe because we were unprepared for it. It was just after my wife had our first child, a daughter, Louisa, and I left the country, I think, when she was a week old. So we were living in this tiny bed. A bed sit is like an apartment. It's got a bedroom, I suppose, and a little living room on the side. So I felt bad about leaving her. So we went on this tour. I was really emotionally unready. I was unprepared for it. And Dave and Mick had just gone through this incident where, you know, they'd had this fight on stage and David had these 9 stitches in his head and had the cymbal thrown at him. So it was a disaster waiting to happen, really, or a tragedy waiting to happen. And we just didn't get along. It was just a series of really unlucky events. And eventually it culminated in a ban by, again, I don't really know, promoters or the union or whatever. Sometimes it's best to leave it alone. And they did, and we couldn't come back for 4 years.
I mean, when you got back after the American tour, I guess that's about the time that your music changed from, you know, the more rock and roll oriented style to a more almost like social satire.
Yeah.
Songs about people living in the suburbs, songs that commented on, you know, the social mores of the time.
Yeah, well, I realised I was on this, as I said, a journey, this wonderful journey that started with You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting. And now I could really get and write about people I knew about. And because You Really Got Me was about this frustrated, well, this tormented teenager, you know, who just wanted, I suppose it was a girlfriend for the sake of it, you know, just take a girl out after a dance, you know, go out together in the car, whatever. But now I could write about people I'd known when I was growing up. Songs like Autumn Almanac, which was really was about a man, a little hunchback man who used to live near me, who was a gardener, and he used to walk around the streets, and the kids used to be scared of him, and because, you know, he was an oddity. And I've always, in a sense, been drawn to people like that, odd people who are like, not outcasts from society, but don't walk the straight line again. You know, the Kinks of society, I guess.
Well, did you find yourself reading different literature or listening to different music when you started writing different kinds of songs?
What I found when, that period, there were lots of people knocking on my door, like, pretending to want to be my friends, who just wanted to know what the trick was.
What do you mean, the trick?
The trick of writing songs that everybody liked.
Oh.
And they got really upset when they couldn't. It's like going to find the formula, you know, of an eccentric scientist somewhere. Once you got the formula, you get out. But they couldn't find the formula because I think my formula was really simple. I just wrote about these events and people and things I loved.
Well, you must have really confused people, though, because very, very few songwriters at that time were writing about characters. Songs were expected to be kind of autobiographical. Mm. Like Randy Newman has confused a lot of people by writing songs, often about very unlikable characters. So I figure the song that confused the people the most probably was Lola, which is about somebody who picks up someone who he thinks is a woman and turns out to be a man.
Mm.
So did that song confuse a lot of people? And maybe you could tell us the story behind writing it.
Although I don't really touch on it in my book, Lola was a song really about not so much confused identity, but more being protective of my own emotions. I draw on lots of different characters when I write a song. I don't really... And it's very rare I write about one thing. And the fact that Lola was a transvestite is incidental. It was really a love song. And all it says, really, is that I'm in love with somebody, or that the singer is in love with somebody who may not be everybody's taste or whatever, but he's made that commitment. That's all it's about, really. And the rest is just dressing, mm-hmm. or cross-dressing.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. Yeah. So was it based on someone who you knew or an incident that happened?
Oh, no, it was based on an actual incident, that part of it. In Paris, we used to go to this wonderful club called the Castel. It was a bit seedy. It was in Paris. But at the time, everybody went there. The Stones used to go there, and a lot of actresses and a lot of models and people. And we used to go down there and dance all night and come out the next morning and go to work and not worry about a thing, and or not notice anything. And one night, my manager was there, and he was dancing away, and Robert was a lovely guy. He was a stockbroker, really should have stayed a stockbroker. And he was 6 foot six tall and very thin, typical English, you know, Terry Thomas, a gent. He said, "Oh, Ray, I think I've got on to something here, old boy." I said, "What? See that beautiful girl over there? I'm going to take her out. I think I'd go home with her." And then it was okay until he got into the daylight and realised this girl had lots of stubble on her face, you know, as a guy. But she was really, really attractive to look at until you get in the daylight. So that I used that story, but that had occurred some years before I wrote Lola. So I used that and adapted that and put that in as kind of a subplot in the song. But then it ended up being the main focal point of the song, really. But as I said, the song is really about a love song. It's a love thing. Maybe a love that people shouldn't know about.
Well, let's hear Lola.
I met her in the club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like cherry cola. C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola. L-O-L-A, Lola. Lola, Lola, Lola. Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy, but when she squeezed me tight she nearly broke my spine.
That's the Kinks recording Lola. There's a live version on the new Kinks collection, Come Dancing. Our interview with Ray Davies was recorded in 1995. Coming up, an interview with Richard Pryor. This is Fresh Air.